Hello and welcome to AFPT Comics Podcast, episode 74. My name is David Brook and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how are you doing? We missed you last week.
Hello! I am back. I had a little birthday staycation, but I am back. Thank you to Nathan for holding down the ship for me. I'm excited to be here to talk about comics. They're kind of sort of back, these comics.
They are. Every publisher is now back to shipping to comic shops.
My county is in phase two, which means myself and four other people can be in the comic store.
Oh, so the store is open.
Yeah.
Nice.
Phase two in Washington State means that five people can be in a retail location as long as there's a reasonable accommodation to keep them the hell away from each other.
Nice. I don't think we're there yet with masks. I think we're still on phase one. We just opened hair salons.
And I did get a comic shop gift card for my birthday.
Oh, congratulations.
So I'm excited to hop into that, tuck into that. I'm probably not going to get comics. I might get the new D&D book. We'll see how it shakes out.
Nice, nice. Well, later on in the show, Chip Mosher is going to be on. He's going to be talking about Blacking Out, a new Kickstarter that he already funded.
This is incredible success.
That's going to be later on in the show. He's also the head of content at Comixology, has a storied history, over 20 years working at Boom, Oni, on and on. We go into it. We talk
in movies.
And movies, too. The guy lives in L.A., of course. Everyone works in movies in L.A.
Everybody does. Yeah.
No, but we talk a lot about Blacking Out and his work with Tom Muller and Peter Krause. And it's a new crime Kickstarter comic book, graphic novel, oversized.
Prestige graphic novel.
Yes. Totally check that out on his Kickstarter. It looks really cool. We got an early look. It is really cool.
It is fantastic. I enjoyed reading it very much. It's a little dark, a little depressing. Sure. But you know, sometimes it feels good right now to lean into that stuff.
Right.
Other people's lives could be worse than mine.
That's true. That's true. No more so than this week.
Yes. Can we take a second to address that?
Sure.
Real quick.
Yeah.
So I just want to say unequivocally, and I think I speak for both of us, that this podcast has the opinion that Black Lives Matter. I know that it's incredibly important to say that in these kinds of white male dominated spaces, like comics are, still very much are, unfortunately. And we are two white males running a comics podcast. So I think it's important to say that I think we both support that movement. I think we both support community organization and retaliation against unjust things. And if you have the means to donate your time, either in calling your legislators or your money to funds.
Yeah, there's a lot of good funds out there too.
Petitions and funds and fundraising for bail and for numerous other things. I'm much farther left than this podcast will ever get to, but yeah, I think it is fair to say for both of us that we support those.
Definitely.
Initiatives.
Yeah, do what you can. Even just, you know, being vocal on social media or with your friends and family is important.
Absolutely. And especially, you know, in, like I said, in these nerdy spaces, which are typically overruled by the white straight male opinion, you know, ask your Black comics friends, Black comic store owners, Black comics creators, give credence to their stories and their opinions, sit back and listen and be empathetic and take care of each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Speaking of comic stores, we're gonna dive right into the news here.
That was a sick segue. SIQ.
Vault Bound Initiative. This is Vault Comics' initiative to help continue expanding and help the comic stores out there that are struggling. They came out with this new initiative for the month of June, and it's interesting because they get into numbers. Basically, they straight out just say $1 copy net pricing for all the number one issues in June and July, $6.50 copy net pricing for all new trade paperbacks, full returnability on all number ones, shipping in both months, full returnability for all subsequent issues, number twos,
number two
in
plus
June and July. Yes.
So not just the second issue, which is a bigger bullet to bite, I think.
That's
a lot of money tied up in potentially return product.
A lot, yeah. I mean, you're taking a very small risk going with Vault in June and July.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. I mean, every comic store.
Vault CEO Damian Wassel said, "We succeed together with comic shops or not at all."
Yep.
If we can help comic shops reduce risk, improve margins, and stabilize cash flow, that's good for them, it's good for us, and it's good for everyone who loves comics. That includes me.
That's true. It does include you.
He's talking directly to me.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say real quick?
Yeah.
Obviously, this is a very good initiative. Vault is putting out some of the best comics in the industry right now, not just indie comics, including materials that the Big Two are putting out. Some of their stuff, Fearscape, The Savage Sores, all that stuff is really fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised at all that this letter came from Missoula, Montana?
Well, that's where all their press releases come from.
I am surprised. I did not know Montana was the seat of indie comics power.
I like how you phrase that. I've only known because I post these press release news pieces on AIPTComics.com.
Mm.
But I can see where that is confusing, or not confusing, but surprising, because that doesn't seem like the location of most comic publishers, right? Usually it's like...
I mean, really, we're talking about LA,
yeah, New York. Yeah.
And Missoula, Montana. And one of those things is not like the other.
It's true. It's very high north. It's very middle country.
Yes, it's strange. I'm going to Montana for the last week of July for a little vacation.
Going to
so
Montana.
So maybe I'll pop right into Vault.
Are you going to go Big Willy style?
I don't know what the fuck that means.
In our next bit of news, Marvel is canceling 53 variants, according to Newsarama.com.
Womp womp.
Three themed programs. And I want to say, the Dark Marvel variants that they've already shown, which you can look at online, are freaking awesome. Yeah. Awesome. I was so excited for these.
Some of these are really cool.
I'm not a variant cover buyer, and I saw some of those, and I'm like, I'm going to buy that and frame that. That is so pretty.
Yeah.
And so
it kind of sucks.
It does kind of suck. And there's quite, I mean, 53 variants, that's a lot. So this is in our news section, because it's like, what does this mean, right? I mean, these artists probably are still getting paid, let's hope. They have to be, right?
I mean, they've already turned in the work. It was already solicited for covers, right?
Right.
Like, it would be improper, I think, to withdraw payment.
Right. Now, whether or not this art shows up anywhere remains to be seen, but this clearly shows that they are not putting the same amount of volume of books out in the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Can I float a kind of interesting idea that I had when I saw this news?
Sure.
Would you buy it if Marvel put out a coffee table book of their variant covers every year?
Ooh, interesting. Coffee table, like a coffee table size book.
Like a treasury-sized hardcover book.
Sitting right next to me is the 75 Years of Covers Art hardcover oversized
book. Yes, in that vein,
yeah.
But yearly.
Yeah, I think I would. That's a really cool way to like show the year of art. Like show the themes, show like not only the themes, but also like what was going on in comic storytelling for Marvel or whoever wants to do that. I don't know if it should be hardcover, but yeah, if it was softcover, I think the price would be right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because a hardcover of that magnitude would be like $100, I think.
I think that they would be relatively expensive, yeah. But you're basically buying for the fact that you didn't purchase them at the time they came out.
Ooh. Follow-up question.
Yeah.
Does this reduce the variant cover issue sales? Because everyone's like, I'll just get the big...
Yeah, see, I don't know. I think we've talked about... There's quite a few folks that are upset that like that Hawkeye series, that Titans, some other books are ending digital.
Yeah.
And Supergirl is one of them as well.
Right.
And I know that folks are upset about that. So I think that your variant cover buyers and speculators would probably still buy.
Right. Because there's some like supposed worth.
Value.
Yeah, value.
Yeah. And that value is tied to the portability, the factor, and the immediacy of the single issue.
Right.
And repurposed in like a treasury-sized volume. I don't think that that's necessarily the same thing.
And I mean, they do usually collect these variant covers in trade paperbacks.
Yes, usually in the back matter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of back matter, DC and Diamond are off to a rough start.
They're in the shit.
Yes, in the back. They're in the back seat. Going, what's happening? I'm falling off the backseat. So anyway, it's come to light that a bunch of books were not shipped by Diamond to comic stores as they were supposed to. And DC literally had to tell UCS and Lunar, the other two distributors that they've been using during these downtimes, to hold their releases, even though they had them ready to go, so that certain comic shops, you know, some comic shops weren't punished because they worked with Diamond and didn't get the books for a week or two later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Basically, we don't really know why this happened. I don't think Diamond ever came out and explained it, but DC basically communicated in not so harsh terms, yo, get your shit together.
Yeah, I think basically they said, well, actually the direct quote here is, DC has made every effort to support Diamond's return to operations and to ensure that our products are received at their warehouses on time for their scheduled dates. Unfortunately, once DC product is received by our distributors for a specific in-store date, they are responsible for how and when they are delivered to comic shops. If you experience shipping delays, we encourage you to work with your distributor to resolve these issues. DC goes on to say that they have communicated, in quotes, with all these distributors regarding these problems, and our expectations is that they will address these problems in a timely manner with you. And that's directly to retailers, obviously.
Right, so not it, basically. We didn't.
No, yeah, basically not it. DC saying we handed off the product and Diamond didn't deliver, and it's actually made us have to go to our other distributors and tell them to hold. Which, actually, I'm going to pick up. This news is later in our notes. But Steve Jeppy had an interview with Newsarama where he made the case for Diamond as the primary direct market distributor in 2020. Steve Jeppy said, when Diamond came in, no one got books a day earlier, but no one got them a day later than anyone else either. Consistency.
Well, he's going to have to get those ones.
Right. He goes on to say in a very strange quote, here now, Diamond respects stability. Some people complain that all the eggs being in one basket... Here now, Diamond represents stability. Some people complain about all the eggs being in one basket. But if it's a solid basket, it's fine. We're not abusing the system. We were investigated by the government to not be a monopoly. We are benign and good for the industry. I think that DC, if not to say creators, retailers, and other publishers... at least currently, would disagree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like every Easter when I get a really good basket. it's an interesting analogy, isn't it?
You think just like Diamond.
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out with DC and Diamond.
Yeah. I mean, their relationship's obviously super tenuous. And I think when relationships get that tenuous, there's a lot of miscommunication that takes place.
Yeah. For sure.
Probably on both sides, especially while DC is trying to get this other distribution model set up with these other distributors.
Yeah.
They're probably like, oh, we checked off Lunar, we checked off whoever. They've got Midtown, they've got a bunch of other partners in this now, and that makes the noise much more significant.
Right.
And maybe Diamond is attempting to take advantage of that. Maybe they're not, and DC's just not communicating as clearly as they thought they were. It's impossible to know. But I did tell you off air that this makes me think, at the very least, that DC's Tuesday release schedule will be extending farther than I would like.
Yeah, I have a feeling Diamond's not so happy about that.
I can't imagine they are.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if you go to a store that's shipped by Lunar, you're going to get your book a day earlier.
Right.
Unless the comic shops are told to hold. No, they're not. The books are sold on Tuesday.
No, they're not. Yeah. They're scheduled for Tuesdays. Yeah.
It's interesting.
The DC comics coming out next week are scheduled for June 2nd.
Yep. Speaking of scheduling, about a month or two ago now, Marvel came out and said, in June, we're coming back, but we're coming back with new issues every other week and then new trades every other week opposite that. Well, it turns out this week we find out those weeks where there were no new single issues, there will be, but they will be digital only.
Right.
Week of June 3rd, that's next week, June 17th and July 1, those will be digital only releases. And a couple of them are no surprises at all. Avengers of the Wastelands was one of their digital only books that was turned digital only from hard copy. But some new ones in the mix now, Revenge of the Cosmic Ghost Rider, Scream, Curse of Carnage, and Valkyrie, all now digital only titles.
Mm-hmm. Joining other books, of course, including Hawkeye as well.
And Ant-Man, yeah. So two takeaways. It looks to me like maybe Valkyrie is going to be ending sooner than maybe some anticipated. Maybe not. We don't know. Most of these books were only supposed to be miniseries or we already knew they were going to be miniseries and going to be cut short. Like Scream Curse of Carnage was not going to be a 50-issue run.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting to see the staggered release model. I think on one hand that it's cool that they found a way to get comics to people. Mm-hmm. People are invested in those series. Actually, we talked about Hawkeye, and I called it out earlier because that's been commercially and critically successful.
Yeah.
So that one is kind of surprising, and I'm sure folks that are glad to get their hands on it. At the same time, I think alternating weeks where you've got physical comics to expect and digital comics to expect is very confusing.
Yeah.
I when we picked our books for next week, books we're looking forward to, I had a hard time tracking down what books are actually coming out from most of the publishers.
Yeah.
So that was difficult. I still don't think it's being communicated very clearly. It's not being updated. consistently across the web. It's in like blog posts on Marvel and DC's websites and not on their actual release calendars.
Right.
That's very confusing. That problem's going to be exacerbated by this mix of digital and physical copies. However, I'm sure that our friend Chip Mosier and those at Comixology are very happy.
They are getting 100% of some cut of those books.
Yes.
When before it was probably much smaller. I noticed on Reddit a lot of folks were very angry. Some were saying, I'm going to quit comics. This is going to make me quit comics. And, you know, just outraged that I can't collect, not me, but speaking for them, I can't collect this in physical format for my long boxes. This is pissing me off. Now, Marvel has come out in the same press release and said they will be collected in trade paperbacks, as we kind of all assumed. So they will be physical at some point, just not in a single issue format. But you know what? Whatever. at the end of the day, so often this news, and I see the outrage, I'm just like, whatever, guys. Just calm down. Like, well, Spider-Man shouldn't do that. Well, it doesn't matter. In 2 years, Spider-Man will be dead. You know, whatever, man.
Yeah.
Moving on to other Marvel news, though. Marvel's top brass takes to social media to share in celebrating Marvel's return to comic shops this week. There was a video they posted across all social media, including, I guess, I would say their top creators, and also their editor-in-chief, C.B. Cebulski.
Those X-Men folks are so hot.
Hot in the streets.
Oh, wow, that's a callback.
It's a callback to the early days of the show. I have to say, I wrote the news on this. I didn't have to. I just saw it. And I was like, I'm going to write something about this. I loved seeing the creators' workspaces, not workspaces, but their homes, like just a little touch of like their personality in the background.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, they were angled in a way that was just like the outside or whatever. But I don't know. It's like a little wrinkle.
Yeah, can we talk about Gary Duggan's straight up chaotic energy?
Yeah, go ahead.
He's like out on the street, but there's like a flyer. His like... what do you call that? Banner.
Yeah.
Behind him.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is like half of his face. And I don't know. It was very him. I respected it. Teenies was also very her.
Yeah, that one. That one was up
witchy goth stuff.
Totally framed. Lighting. Tons of effort went into like how that looked. That looked cool. I liked how Donny Cates was like in a muscle shirt or like a rolled up t-shirt on like a just a simple deck.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting that. Clearly, some people took a little more time to get those backgrounds right, but either way, it was pretty fun. Mark Brooks's workspace is amazing. It's like the coolest man cave ever, if you want to call it that. Anyway, not the biggest news of the week, of course, but I thought it would be fun to call that out. You could check out that video on aptcomics.com. In our next bit of news, DC announces Instagram-exclusive Batman comics.
Yeah, this is weird. taking a page out of TKO.
Yeah, yeah. Alternative marketing, I guess.
Yeah, a very long time ago, actually, I forwarded you some Instagram. TKO put the first issue of the first season of their books in Instagram stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had quite a bit of fun clipping through them. So I would imagine that DC saw the success of that, or someone told DC about the success of that, and now they're biting it for these Instagram-exclusive Batman teasers, including... our friend, Punchline.
Our best friend. Best of friend. We got the full preview of her on aptcomics.com this week, beating Harley's ass pretty hard. Harley loses a fight, and I think so. I saw some fans on Twitter. They were kind of mad about that.
Well, you keep bringing up the fans. People are going to be mad about everything all the time. I think that this is kind of neat. I think it's innovative. They're obviously biting the smaller guys that are faster on their feet and leaning into the digital space harder and faster than DC and Marvel have been able to.
Yeah.
But why not? Cool.
Yeah, I think there's a different audience
on
Instagram, too.
Does this make Punchline's first appearance an Instagram exclusive? How does that work?
I don't know. She's had like 3 first appearances now, so... Or maybe more like 10. I don't know. I think she appeared in... She appeared in a Kool-Aid ad, I think, 5 years ago, didn't she?
iPhone 10 that was used to post Punchline Instagram exclusive.
Oh, God. I think it was a BlackBerry, actually. She first appeared.
Oh, God.
It was Obama's BlackBerry.
Those chiclet keyboards are so hot.
They are so hot in the streets. In our last bit of news, Marvel's bringing back Marvel mini books.
Yeah, these are tiny.
Smallest comics of all time.
Yes.
When are these coming out? I don't think it says.
It does not say. Okay. But back in 1966, Marvel printed 6 one-shot comic books spotlighting the origins of their most popular characters at the time. Those, of course, being The Amazing Spider-Man, The Mighty Thor, The Incredible Hulk, Captain America, Sergeant Nick Fury, and...
The biggest one
Millie
of them all.
The Model.
Oh, it's out August 18th in a box set.
Oh, okay. They're being reprinted facsimile style in the same size they were. Smaller than a postcard, postage stamp.
Mm.
They will be smaller than a postage stamp again.
Oh my God, you totally just like did like a Seinfeld thing the way you said that. I love it.
They'll need to be read with tweezers and a microscope, I suppose. I do think it would be cool if they put them out, if you got a collection that was like a bigger size, like a golden book size,
yeah,
and then the tiny ones. Mm-hmm. But I think for folks that have these or collectors that have always wanted this kind of retro type thing in their collection, it's very cool.
I think that she'd come with like 5 copies of each box set just because you're going to lose 2 of them when you just open the packaging.
Yeah.
The wind's going to take it. Oh, boy. In our next segment, Top Books of Last Week, we talk about our top two favorite books of last week. And always we start with comic book roundups.
Oh, man. Top I got to get back into it.
This is your first time back.
This is my first time.
Woo!
First time caller.
The top critic pick on comicbookroundup.com was He-Man and the Masters of the Universe number 6, the 9.8. We had those creators on, Jesus, it felt like a million years ago.
I think it was at least 4 months ago, yeah.
Yeah, when issue 1 came out. And then the top fan pick was Suicide Squad number 5 with an 8.9, and I do not disagree with them. I like that issue as well. Tom Taylor's killing it with Bruno Redondo on art. Forrest, tell us what your second favorite comic of the last week was.
My second favorite comic of last week was Dr. Aphra, number 1, written by Alyssa Wong, with art by Marika Cresta. This is the, I would say it's kind of a soft relaunch of the Dr. Aphra series for Marvel. Archaeologist with chaotic Han Solo energy type book. This very much feels like a chapter 2, in that it still owes everything to the character originally written by Kieran Gillen and Cy Spurrier.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun. It's a fun book. I think on most weeks, I would say that this is an okay book.
Yeah.
But on a week where like 10 issues came out, it's a good book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It reestablishes some pretty high stakes for the character, which is good. Not necessarily as high as being tied intimately to Darth Vader.
Right.
As the previous run was. But it's got that good, campy, yet serious Star Wars energy that you need, I think.
I swear to God.
A lot of ulterior motives and people just being like, oh yeah, these rings were made by a secret cursed Jedi order. and their names are ridiculous. And that's fun.
It is always fun.
I like crazy, kooky world building. It has a fun, light energy.
The day Disney says, in our next film is Dr. Aphra, I think people are going to lose their minds.
Yeah.
Everybody wants
it. I would go big for a Dr. Aphra or a Ahsoka movie.
I feel like I'd rather have a Dr. Aphra show, to be honest. I feel like it's more episodic. Yeah.
And I think that's what this issue leans into well. It feels episodic.
Nice.
Like it's just it's kind of like an Indiana Jones style, like, all right, here's another heist.
right, exactly. You know? You could start anywhere in that. She could be in the middle of like a death trap or just starting a mission.
Yeah.
My second favorite book was Alien number 3 from Boom Studios. That's by Cy Spurrier and Chris Wildgus. I don't want to talk too much about this because I think it might be coming up later in the show. But I will say one of the best written, paced, drawn books out there. It's sad that it's a miniseries, but it's also exciting how each issue delivers so much, jumps ahead just enough so that you feel like you're getting something brand new every step of the way. It's really a good book. I think everyone should pick it up. It's probably best read in single issue format because there are these gaps in the story that allow you to kind of think about things while you wait and then while you read the issues too.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite book of the last week?
my favorite book of last week is Alienated number 3, written by Cy Spurrier with art by Chris Wildgus.
Yo.
Again, this is a Boom miniseries that I actually wish had been announced as like a maxi series. And I think I told you when I read it that I think that they could get this thing going for 25-50 issues.
Wait a minute. Boom's like known for turning mini into maxi, right? Like they did that
Come
on. I'm just put your money where your mouth is, buddy.
I'm just saying, Cy, Boom, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
We've had them all on the podcast. Yep. They're good friends of mine, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
No, a very good issue. It's very serious, but I think that it explores in a very interesting way what teens, especially alienated teens, it's quite literal, do when they're given power or do when they're given autonomy and the kind of recognition that they realistically should have all of the time, emotionally, physically, familially, romantically. It explores all of those issues, and it explores someone going to the very edge of that power and then stepping back from the precipice in a very emotionally impacting way. And I think Sai is one of the best writers right now in general, but also one of the best writers at writing relatable characters. And I didn't necessarily go as far as any of these kids are going, but you know, the alienation that you feel in grade school in particular is very real and relatable in this book. And I'm of course always surprised by the fact that all these guys are over in Britain and that it maps to our experiences so well. But I think that speaks to how universal it is. Sure, it also has an incredibly powerful yet cute Aztecan masked cat alien looking for ice cream through a bunch of portals.
Wild Goose draws Chip, the alien, so well. Yeah. Like, even when the alien's not even a prominent thing in the panel, it's doing something.
Yeah, I like its presence a lot. I think it gives a bit of levity to the book, but then also this hint of like the mystique and the alien. It's very cool.
Yeah.
I would have had so many more questions if I had known any of this stuff when we interviewed them after reading the first issue.
Yes.
Thinking about that, like, that interview would be totally different now.
Right. I wish we could do more exit interviews, like get someone on to the beginning of books, which is, you know, a prominent thing we do because, you know, the publishers want to hype the book before it comes out. But then do an excellent interview and be like, okay, let's talk about Alienated now.
I mean, I would be very interested in that for this series. Do kind of a spoiler cast.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
My favorite book was Avengers number 33 by Jason Aaron and Javi Garone. This is the first part of a new arc, so great timing if you want to jump onto something new. Art is amazing. Art is so good. It's like the super detailed superhero art you come to expect from the big two. But if you like Moon Knight, don't pass on this. I'm trying to do like a salesman thing. Jeff Lemire made me really interested in Moon Knight. I was always like interested, but like, you know, it seems like kind of like an underwritten character with lukewarm powers. And then he brought it into the psychological realm that I thought was more fascinating than what other creators had done in the past.
Interesting.
Why is that interesting?
I had heard some scuttlebutt that a lot of people didn't feel like this was Moon Knight.
Oh, in Avengers?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just talking about Jeff Lemire's Moon Knight.
Sure.
Now,
sure.
This Moon Knight, this is interesting because I can kind of spoil it because the whole point of the book is watching Moon Knight beat Avengers up. And we're starting to learn that he has more power when a certain god gives it to him, I think. That's my take. Anyway, there are ruminations here from Jeff Lemire's work. It's not as prominent, but like the multiple personalities, it comes out in one scene. Mm-hmm. And I think Jason Aaron does a great job linking back to that. But at the same time, he's doing something different with the character. He's making him more, I think, sellable, if that's the right word. Probably it's less cheap than that, than what I'm making it out to be. But I think a lot of people are going to pick this up and be like, holy shit, Moon Knight's really cool. You could do a lot more with this character because the powers are far beyond what we may think of the character. So I think he's expanding the character, sort of like how Venom was for the longest time, pretty much just a strong dude who could swing around and that's about it. But then Donny Cates came around and now we understand that this character is connected to one of the most powerful forces in the universe. I feel like Aaron is taking Moon Knight and blending that largeness of scale of importance onto the character, which may or may not be earned, but we'll see by the end of the arc. I think he's kind of doing that with this, so that's one of the main reasons why I was so interested in this first issue.
I am a big Moon Knight fan. My best friend is a really big Moon Knight fan. I looked up how much the first appearance of Moon Knight would be for him, because our friend officiated our wedding.
Yeah.
And I then quickly decided I wasn't going to spend roughly $15,000.
Whoa. That's a lot.
On a friend's gift.
I'd love to know what they think about this issue if they pick it up.
Yeah. I'll have them read it. And I will definitely take a look too, because I am a big Moon Knight fan. He's been poorly written. He's been very well written over time.
It's a hard character, right?
As I alluded to, I did hear a lot of people say that they felt like this character wasn't Moon Knight at all. Mm-hmm. By which I mean that it didn't read like previous Moon Knight works. Not that it was someone pretending to be Moon Knight.
Right.
So I'll have to decide for myself, but I'm definitely interested.
Nice, yeah. And I think we need to see where the arc goes too. I think this is just the drop in the bucket. Speaking of drops in the bucket, you guys want to know what our top books for next week are? In this segment, we talk about the number one book that we're looking forward to next week. I'm going to go first, please, and thank you. Do I have permission?
I'm powerless.
May I pass? I need to be allowed in. I'm a vampire. My number one book for next week is Far Sector number 6. This one's by N.K. Jemisin with Jamal Campbell on art. All the art. Guy does it all. This book, I think, is more important than ever based on the news this week. This book is about rising up. This book is about taking to the streets because you're the unheard. This book literally quotes MLK. Not this issue necessarily. I haven't read the issue yet, but it has in this story arc. I think this book is really important for those reasons. It's also great sci-fi. It's just beautiful. I've loved Jamal's work for years, and it's so cool to see him do it all on a new story arc. And I think a lot of people will connect with this if they haven't yet, especially with the way the world is right now. And that's the fact.
Cool.
What is your top book for next week?
My top book for next week, I don't have anything poignant to say about it. It's Swamp Thing Giant number 4.
Nice.
This is one of the issues that came out in Walmart's originally, and I'm excited for it because nobody read it in Walmart.
Right. Oh man, I just started reading Nancy Collins' run on Swamp Thing, and I can't believe I hadn't read it till now. Man, Swamp Thing is such a good character when written well.
Yes, I think I will return to the Brian K. Vaughan read that I started roughly 13 years ago.
Nice. Moving on. Judging by the cover, Junior. What is your favorite cover art out next week? Orst.
My favorite cover art out next week is Revenge of the Cosmic Ghost Rider number 5.
Nice.
And this is the 5th issue.
Hell yeah. In
the series. Number 5. With cover art by Scott Hepburn.
Whoop, whoop.
It's just cool. It's a Demons. Crazy over-the-top sci-fi. Cosmic Ghost Rider is wrapped around the waist by demons. One of them's got his face, like, stretching all the way from, like, his right leg around his back and around his wrist. He's reaching up. His head is exploding like a small supernova. It's got a bit of, a Mike Mignola flair, too.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those sharp shadows. And I love the title treatment on this series. The mix of, like, the revenge of the is, like, fiery, more typical Cosmic Ghost or Ghost Rider billing. And then the Cosmic Ghost Rider is very obviously aping Star Wars. And it's cool.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah. My favorite cover art out next week is one of the, I think it's like 8 variant covers for the Catwoman 80th anniversary issue. Yeah, this one was the 1940s cover. It's by Adam Hughes. And since it's the 1940s cover, it is the 1940s costume of Catwoman, where she has like the, I would say, ridiculous ears and green cape. I love Adam Hughes's work. There's a dynamic element when it comes to lighting that's always very cool. Atmospheric, and he's very good at using foreground, middle ground, and background, and how those three things interact. So in this cover, we've got, by the way, if you go to aptcomics.com and you can actually see the full cover art right there, he's got this whip coming right at you at the bottom right, and then you've got Catwoman in the middle and the midground, and then behind her is like the city, and it's sort of lit up because of a Zeppelin way out there.
Yeah, and the fabric on Catwoman is unreal.
Yeah, it's really cool. It looks so realistic.
I cannot believe how realistic it is.
And it's sexualized, but I don't think it's overly sexualized. I don't know. Maybe it is a little.
I mean, I think it is. It undeniably is. But it's also like in keeping with the campiness and the sexuality, the femininity.
And she's looking
of
like
the Catwoman character.
She's having the time of her life. She's like so happy.
I do like how fun it is.
Yeah.
But she's obviously. He's leaning into the campy, kind of sexualized history of the character.
Yeah, and we have to say, I mean, Catwoman's one of the most overly sexualized characters in history, I'd say, right?
Yeah, sure.
Especially in the 90s. Good Lord, look at some of those covers. Yeah. Not to get negative.
But, it is obviously camped up for the anniversary issue aspect.
Right.
Your mileage may vary.
100-page spectacular. $10. That's going to be on the list for one of the most high-selling books of the month. I'm going to just call it right now. Anywho, in our next segment, we're going to have Chip Mosier on to talk about Blacking Out, the new Kickstarter that he's doing with Peter Krause and Tom Muller. And he's also going to talk about his career and genealogy. That's right, genealogy. He's also the head of content at Comixology. Thanks so much for being on the show, Chip.
Not a problem. Happy to be here.
Good. So Blacking Out, being already funded, congratulations, first of all. Your Kickstarter states this work is 3 years in the making, but when did the bud of the idea start?
Oh, man. You know, the core plot element, I probably came up in my late teen years, you know, growing up reading comics. I was like, oh, man, I can't, you know, I'm going to write comics one day. Mm. And so I was always like coming up with like, I was like, but I have to have a good plot. I have to have a good plot. So I have about a hundred probably plots in like notebooks somewhere. And then, you know, at a certain point in my life, I realized that, you know, plot isn't the only thing to writing. And then, you know, and then you come to the slow realization that you're maybe the slowest writer in comics. And so, so I'm the least prolific person in comics. This is my second published work in 20 years.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, so in 10 years, we'll be talking about my third book.
And you'll be 25, right?
I'll be 25, yeah. I did, my previous work was Left on Mission with Francesco Francavilla. It's one of Francesco's first comics that he did, which is great. So, you know, during the middle of that, I got hired at Boom Studios along with Mark Wade. And, you know, Boom wasn't really, you know, it wasn't even ranked in the top 20 comic publishers. And then 2 years later, we were the number 6 direct market publisher in North America. And that was quite a rocket ride and a lot of work. You know, focusing on making Boom a success became really my main focus. And you know, my writing career took a back seat, and mostly because in an office next to Mark Wade and sort of looking over there and contemplating, gosh, I don't think I'll ever be able to write like this guy writes. And he writes a lot and does, and, you know, writes consistently. And I am so slow. And then I just realized, you know, I'm really good at doing marketing and PR. And so, you know, I'll focus on that. And I focused on that. And, that, you know, that was a pretty good choice. You know, focus on your strengths.
Sure.
But it's been good to circle back and be able to do another creative project.
And with the idea in place, however long and however many permutations it took to get to, what specific goals did you have in mind when you set out to start the Kickstarter? And what made you feel like Kickstarter was the right platform for this project?
Well, you know, it's funny. A couple of people have asked me, like, why didn't you do this at Comixology Originals? And, you know, there's a handful of answers to that question. You know, the first thing is, you know, I really needed to keep a separation between church and state, and a separation between what I'm doing with this project and what I'm doing with my day job. You know, there's an internal approval process at the corporate level to do outside projects. And when I got that approved, you know, I was still still leading the communications. And then about a year and a half later, I moved into the head of content role, leading up the Comixology Originals, which is the exclusive content line for Comixology and Kindle. There's no one in the who did any of the reward lobby cards that currently have a pitch into Comixology Originals, who has worked with Comixology Originals. And then I have business relationships with all the publishers, and that just gets weird. And there's just a whole bunch of conflict of interest that I just wanted to avoid from, you know, an HR perspective internally on the corporate level, and just from a perceptional level. You know, I just wanted this book to stand on its own 2 feet and no one to say that I was getting any special consideration. And so the response has been overwhelming. It's been super nice. It's amazing to be funded at the level that we are right now, which is 3,409%.
Live update. Oh, nice. I can see that it certainly makes that success feel more organic and earned.
Right. It's fan promoted.
Yeah. And look, you know, like the last time you had this much diversity of content and this many ways to, you know, read comic books and get exposed to new material, I think was in the late 80s when I was working, you know, at Phoenix Comics and Games in Houston, Texas, on Gessner and Nabo, and, you know, during the black and white explosion. So that was a fantastic time to be reading comics and selling comics and working in a store and now, you know, you have Comixology, of course, and Comixology Unlimited, which is, you know, right now, you know, just to put my corporate shill hat on, you know, 60-day free trial, you know, and then $5.99 a month for over 25,000 comics and graphic novels. Yeah. And then, you know, of course you have, you know, what Brian K. Vaughan and Marcus Martin is doing over at Panel Syndicate, and Brew Baker just did a something over there, and Alex DeCampi, and that's great. And then, you know, the scrolling format, the Webtoon scrolling format, you have Webtoons, and you have a bunch of other outlets. You have, you know, obviously your local comic shops.
I think I know what Forrest is thinking right now. Forrest, should we ask him about Bad Idea? Chip, what do you think about Bad Idea? This is not a gotcha question.
I love it.
Okay.
I love it.
Okay, good.
You know, I love any, you know, Dinesh and Hunter at Bad Idea are buddies of mine. I thought what they did at Valiant, I'm sure I'm missing a couple of people at Bad Idea, but I thought what they accomplished at Valiant was pretty spectacular. I mean, if I had a recording of my call when they started it, and I called up Hunter and was like, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, totally wrong. You know, they did such a great job. And I think what they're doing with Bad Idea is super smart. And
it's almost like the polar opposite of Comixology Unlimited in that, right? Like, it's limited comics only in comic shops, only select comic shops, never to be put into a digital format.
Sure. I mean, you know, look, I'm a big tent guy. You know, there's a place for everything.
Sure.
You know, and just to pivot back to Kickstarter, you know, you can go, let me see if I can get the URL right here. Scroll down to the bottom of Kickstarter and go, and they have this great thing called stats. Hmm. And you get the stats on, like, on the lifetime of, let's categories.
Oh,
see,
gosh.
All
categories. I've never actually looked at this page.
Yeah, comics, successfully funded, 9,437. Mm. That's amazing.
It is.
You know, and then how many of those have had $1 million raised? There's been one. And then 100K, you know, 130 of them has raised over 100,000. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. I wanted to say, when we were setting this interview up, I think Cosmic Detective from Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent just blew up and scored like $50,000 in the first day, or $100,000 the first day. Duncan Jones is Maddie, obviously, again, huge success. Jimmy Palmiotti and I forget his first name, Johnson, their project, huge success. And then only a day or two later, yours was, well, even the first day, I think, you reached your funding. And you just skyrocketed there too.
8 minutes flat.
Was it? Nice.
Yeah. You know, but who's counting?
It's all stats. Is there any advice you would give to a comics creator who's conceptualizing or launching their own crowdfunded project?
There's a lot of planning involved.
Yeah.
I've had a good career in comics, and I probably have a little bit more resources than your average up and coming crowdfunder, and so I have some people that are helping me out, because I work a day job, and my day job is very intense, and so, you know, I'm working, you know, 40 to 60 hour work weeks, mostly on the 60 hour, you know, you know, pretty consistently. So having someone to help you and plan is good, you know, having outside PR resources, you know, even if you don't have the means to, you know, pay anyone out of pocket to help you, like having a friend that, you know, that you can work with to figure it out. I mean, and also like, you know, I had an idea about how this was going to go. And then I pre-wrote a bunch of updates, you know, thinking that I'd put them out. And then, you know,
eight minutes later,
like, well, you know, it's like, my idea of what it was going to be like, it just didn't work out. And so also I got a very late breaking blurb from a creator that will remain nameless, who I met when I was a kid. And I have the con sketch from the 80s
oh, wow.
of the day that I met him. And, you know, and we've known each other, you know, we're not like tight or anything, but, you know. And so I got like the longest blurb ever, and it's just bowled me over. And so,
nice.
So, and I got that like after we launched. And so now I'm going to, you know, it's like, oh, okay, this is what I should do. I'm going to write an essay about what this person meant to me.
Oh, cool.
And so, you know, now I have to do that, you know, which, you know, along with everything else in my life.
I feel like comics is the most like passion front forward like industry. Everybody's making too little money, but they love it too much not to put in the 90 hour weeks or 60 hour weeks.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a passion. You can certainly make a living at comics. You know, part of it's a lot of hard work. The people that work very, very hard in the industry usually do pretty okay. And so that's good. But yeah, it's definitely, I was talking to someone, they said that like the personal connection, friend nexus mixing with work is very high with comics, probably a little bit higher. And I think that's true. You know, I've worked in the special effects industry for half a second, you know, almost, you know, a little under 20 years ago. And, you know, that was different.
Yeah.
You know, it was different. It wasn't like this, you know, and I just, you know, I've run away from comics a couple of times, but I've always come back. I love the people and I love, you know, I love the medium. And when I get tired of the content, I love interacting with the fans and the other creators. And then when I get tired of them, I love the content, you know, and
just shifts that.
So we've touched on it a little bit, and actually you've done a great job of touching on it, but your history in comics is pretty robust. You worked at Oni, Boom, and now at Comixology for more than half a second, I'd say. from your perspective, and a very unique perspective in the industry, what would you say is something that is surprising that you've seen emerge in comics over the years, and what's a trend that you see as not so surprising, maybe something more inevitable?
I think the thing that distresses me... the most consistently distresses me is the level of negativity about the industry, the discourse about the industry, and how consistent it has been over the decades. If you look at reality, quote unquote, how divorced from reality it is. You know, you go to, you know, go to the Comic-Con ICB2 numbers.
Yeah, we look at those every month, and every couple of months there seems to be like, oh God, the industry's over.
These like the public data, the industry reports, you go to like, okay, where were we? I'm just pulling this up live now. You know, it's like, where were we in 2011? You know, direct market trades, you know, 417.
417, is that 417 million?
Yeah, where are we in 2018 is their last report. And it's like 550, I believe, because I was just looking at this the other day. Mm-hmm. You know, I 510, you know, so digital is destroying the industry. Mm-hmm. Okay, so these years that I just talked to you about is when digital comics has been more widely available than any time ever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I find the thing about the industry that's most distressing is the negativity.
Yeah. lately I've been seeing with DC and Marvel doing digital only, you know, just a smattering of it. I see people on Reddit quite a bit going, oh, well, I'm not going to buy comics anymore. And it's like, well, they're still putting out real comics soon. It's just a couple titles, you know, chill out. But I think it's very reactionary, right? It's a knee-jerk reaction. Is there anything that's not so surprising that you've noticed over the last, how long have you been in the industry?
Just stop.
Sorry, I'm doing the math.
I'm really old.
20,
stop. if you want to, you know, I started working at a comic shop when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
So, if you count that, this is the beginning of my fourth decade.
Wow. That's impressive.
80s, 90s, you know, yeah. So you missed on my CV working at the comic book shops. Working at Capital City, worked at the warehouse over a summer. And then I was involved in a digital comics company in the mid early 90s that no one remembers. and then I was involved with Shannon Wheeler with Too Much Coffee Man and Adhesive Comics. In a sort of ad hoc fashion. And then Oni Entertainment, which, you know, has had like three different names, but you know, that's the last name it had. We did a deal. The first thing of note is we set up the coffin, Hester and Huddleston's coffin, with Jim Cameron's company in 2000, with Guillermo del Toro attached. I hear there's a script in a vault somewhere. Ooh. But that's about as far as that one went.
Pivoting back to Blacking Out really quick, what is it, in your opinion, about the gumshoe detective and the muscle car that just will never go out of style?
I don't know. I just think it's cool. You know, I mean, there's just a cool factor that you can't deny, you know, but I'm kind of messing with that a bit, mm-hmm. right? Because I think there's a cool veneer on most of the characters in Blacking Out, but the back of the book says everything. Mm-hmm. You need to know, mm-hmm. you know, the tagline for the book is bad people doing bad things. So, you know, for me writing it, you know, the thing I wanted to explore is just people, you know, just there's not a good guy, a bad guy. I mean, everyone's a bad guy in this. Mm-hmm. Everyone's a bad guy. I mean, basically, so the crux of the murder is this teenage girl, Karen Littleton. Is you know, there was this forest fire. They put out the forest fire. They find this teenage girl's body, you know, that's been badly burned, and you know, and her dad's an abusive jackass, who had abused her physically, and so he's pegged as the murderer, and there's a line in the book where it's like, just because you're an asshole doesn't mean you killed your daughter. And I mean, he's more than an asshole, but Conrad, the main character, is trying to figure out who really did it. And Conrad was recently kicked off the police force for, you know, I believe there's a passing reference to him being passed out in his patrol car drunk. Right. And then, you know, everyone is just like, it's just bad people doing bad things. And it was so much fun to write.
Nice. Good answer.
So when you're approaching creating a mystery, how do you come up with the various twists and turns? And did you have a lot of those plot beats figured out, or did you discover them in the process of writing the story?
A plot to me is like a dime a dozen. Like, cause I thought plot was really hard, you know, like when I was a teenager. And so I was just like, I was just banking plots all the time in my head. And so the thing that I find the most difficult writing is character and dialogue and getting internal and making sure everyone has their own voice and that. So the plot stuff and, you know, the mystery, I read crime fiction all the time, and
do you have like one of those boards with like yarn all on the wall?
Nah, I'm super like super OCD detail guy, so that's all in my head. It's easy to keep track of. So
you're a detective in a way.
Yeah. Someone broke into my apartment when I was first getting into crime fiction, and I caught him with some detective work. Ooh. And the police were like, "How'd you do that?" I'm like, I just asked around. You know, so I basically, when the police came to my apartment, I had them, you know, I was like, "Hey, you're going to fingerprint around the window where he broke in or she broke in." And they're like, "Oh, okay." And then I, you know, wrote a letter to it was a small apartment complex. And I was like, "Hey, just FYI, this happened." And someone came by and said, "Oh, you know, I thought you let your friend borrow your mountain bike and your boombox and your backpack." I'm like, no, that was the person stealing my stuff.
How long did it take to catch him?
That was like 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. Yeah. So a little gumshoe work.
Yeah. Did
on
that
my
make
part,
you want to become a cop or a detective in any way?
You know, it was interesting. I thought, I was like, this is too easy, you know? And, you know, obviously I had more time and inclination. You know, I mean, I literally, it took me 30 minutes to write this letter and I got all the information I needed. And so when they called me up, they were like, "How'd you do that?" I was like, "Well, I wrote this letter." and I put it under the door of all 10 units in my apartment complex. And then I got a description of the guy. And then, you know, and then I called you and bada boom, bada bing.
How much detective work is there in being the head of content at Comixology?
You know, it's a different kind of detective work. You know, I look at facts and figures and, you know, mostly just judging, you know, whether something, you know, I think is going to be viable for us.
Moving back on to Blacking Out, it has such a sleek and visual style, and it seems to be marrying the 70s and modern aesthetics. Can you tell us how you yourself and Peter Krause and Tom Muller developed the look of the book?
Sure. I basically wrote the script. And I had in my head an idea for what I wanted it to be, and it was more of like sort of, it was probably more on the point blank John Wick side of things than where it came out, and I gave it to Pete, and the script didn't have any, there's no page breakdowns, there's no panel breakdowns, a very sort of more Marvel style. And so one of the reasons, other than like Pete and I just get on like a house on fire, and he's just the nicest guy in the world, you know, Pete has a storyboard background. And so I really dislike comic books that are writer driven, and it feels like the comics that feel like the writer has put a stranglehold on the artist. And like, okay, I want 10 panels on this page, and they're all stadium scenes, you know, and stuff like that just drives me nuts. And you can really just tell, and it doesn't like, it doesn't move. And, mm-hmm. and I wanted someone to be able to pick up the comic book and just look at all the panels and not even read it and know exactly what was going on, which I think is what, you know, at their best, you know, comics should be. So I told Pete to break it down and do the character designs, and he had his own vision for what Conrad looked like. I remember when I first got the thing, I was like, wow, because I lived with the idea like way too long.
Yeah,
you know, so it's like, wow, like the mustache, man, I don't know. And then I was like, you know, as they say in Texas, where I grew up, I gotta just let go and let God. And I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna, you know, I wanted it to be a deep collaboration. I was like, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, I wanted Pete to do his thing. And then I was like, oh, the mustache. And I was like, oh, you know, Chip, shut up. I mean, Pete's artwork on this is just spectacular.
It flows
and
so nicely. Yeah, the pacing's great. We got a chance to look at it early.
Yeah. Just top-notch comic book storytelling. And then, you know, I've always wanted to work with Tom on the design. And you know, part of part of my inspiration, and I had this from the beginning, is doing the French bande dessinée format. And just you're looking at me, so on video, so the people can't see this, but here's a proof of the case cover of Blacking Out against Bad Weekend, and you know there's
the size difference.
Yeah, there's like probably 2 inches in width and an inch and a half in height. I mean, it's humongous comparatively. And so you have a lot, you know, more sort of widescreen storytelling. And I really, you know, having had the privilege of, you know, working for a company has sent me out to France a bunch for, you know, Angoulême, I just fell in love with that 48-page bande dessinée hardcover format. In France, they let, you know, I asked an artist one time, I was like, what's your deadlines like? He's like, oh, you know, when I sign the contract, I have six months to turn in the first page. And then I have 6 months after that to turn in the 48 pages. And I'm like, holy cow, that is not like it is in America.
Yeah.
You know, I told Peter, I was like, look, you know, I don't, you know, I'm doing this for me. And, you know, I want you to do it for you. And I want this to just to be the best you can make it. And so Pete took his time. And then I because we worked the way we did, I went to the letterer next. And because I didn't have a script that matched the pages. So, you know, sending it to Julia was like, I don't know whether it's night or day. And I'm like, and so I had to, like, in the lettering draft, I eventually had to notate that. Right. So I went to Ed Dukeshire, and he lettered the book. And then I, you know, iterated on that and did a bunch of edits with Ed, which is not, you know, not the way comic books are done traditionally. But I really wanted, you know, it to be art driven. You know, you can't make comics without artists. You know, it's not a comic book without the art. And so, and then Ed is just by far one of my favorite letterers, and probably one of the most talented letterers in the business. And the things that he does with word emphasis. You know, he changes the font inside the word balloon, changes the font size. He's doing a lot of crazy thing. And then, you know, he's usually like on super tight deadlines. And so I was like, dude, just take your time. Mm. And so it's like, okay. And then like 3 days later, he's like, I think I'm going to do this. And I'm like, what? And he sends me a panel, and he had hand drawn the word balloon. I mean, he drew it in the computer, but he like hand. So not there's not two word balloons that are the same.
That's interesting. I have to go back now.
That was, so he had the time. Julia did it in between projects, and her work is her work is just stunning. Her color work is just stunning. And then I just gave it to Tom, and I was like, you know, I was like read the book and figure it out, man. Like, I need a logo and I need the design. And I had contacted Tom 3.5 years, you know, I contacted him at the beginning, and he was like, let me know when you're done. And then I was like, hey, Tom, it's been 3.5 years.
I know you're blowing up right now with X-Men, but
yeah. And so of course, like, I contact him, and he's like, well, I'm working on something I can't tell you about. And I'm like, crap. But, you know, so, but then, you know, I don't think you get, you know, I mean, Tom's great with logos, but I think the Blacking Out logo is, I mean, there's just, once you read the story, and this is all book jacket design should do this. You should get it, it should make you want to read the book. And then after you close the book and put it down, you look at the book jacket, and then you go, oh, I get it.
And it's like another story layer.
Yeah, there's another story layer in the book jacket. And so I think people will be, I mean, it's in the logo, it's in the, I mean, the whole, I mean, it's all, yeah, I'm pinch me, you know, it's like, it's a dream how it came out. I just am so happy with it. It's really just without compromise. I mean, we didn't compromise on at any point. And like, you know, and like this proof I'm holding up to you on this video chat.
Yeah.
You know, this is my second round.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that doesn't happen a lot in publishing. But because I'm nuts, there was like a little error in the texture that I found. And I was like, and they're like, oh, do you want to just do a, you know, a PDF? I'm like, no, send me it again, you know, because, you know, I do one of these every 10 years. So it's gotta be right.
It's interesting. We've had folks on the show before who've worked for big publishers before. I won't name names. And they, one of their main complaints is we're forced to work so fast that you're pumping it out without thinking too deeply about it. And it just drags down the like creative process. What you just described is the complete opposite of that.
So, you know, most American fans, comic fans, I don't think realize that the Franco-Belgian market, so France and Belgium, right, is a billion-dollar comic book industry. So with a fifth of the people,
mm-hmm.
right? And so with like 50 million people, you know, there's $1 billion being spent on comic books a year. With 330 million people in the United States, we're spending $1 billion on comics. So it's like Angoulême this year, which was sadly the last convention I went to in January. End of January, you know, President Macron showed up at Angoulême. And you know, I mean, I don't think the president of the United States, even Obama, who was like a big Spider-Man fan, didn't ever show up at Comic-Con. So, you know, it's just, it's a different aesthetic and a different, approach to the art. And, you know, I love American comics. But I think I'd probably be shot in Texas saying this, but I think we have a lot to learn from the French. at least in comics.
They bailed us out in the Revolutionary War, though, so we can't forget that.
They did.
So you mentioned reading a lot of crime fiction, but what other media, or specific books even, movies, TV, informed the development of Blackie Now?
Well, you know, I don't know if people are going to laugh out loud when they read Blacking Out, maybe the second time, but every time, you know, there's a couple of big laugh lines for me, because at very super, super, super dark moments in the story. I mean, the story is really dark, but there's a couple points where I just crack up because I have a warped sense of humor, but part of that, you know, is kind of inspired. Though I'm nowhere near the writer, and Charles Williford is so much more funny, blatantly, and perversely in some senses in his books. So Charles Williford wrote. He's most well known for the Hoke Mosley series, Miami Blues, which was a movie that Alec Baldwin was in. And then there were four sequels. And Williford was in World War II, fought in the Battle of the Bulge. Before he was in World War II, he was in the cavalry. So he joined the military before it was quote unquote professionalized because of World War II, and so there was still a horse cavalry division in like 1938.
Yeah.
And he has this great memoir about like training the horses, training to fight on horses, and just knowing that there was no point. There was absolutely no point. He knew what was happening. He knew that the mechanization of the military was happening. And so he has all these funny stories about like, you know, I'm wasting my life learning how to fight on a horse.
Sort of like Catch 22, machine. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's very Catch 22. And so the guy had a just crazy life, and wrote some really great pulpy noir stuff in the, I think starting in the early 50s, late 40s, and periodically, and then he had long dry spells. And then there was a posthumously published novel that part of it had been published before, part of it hadn't, but it's called Shark Infested Custard, which is probably one of my favorite things that he wrote, and obviously inspired some of the dark humor, dark comedy in Pulp Fiction. Very, like, there's two or three scenes that are really obviously transposed. I won't give it away. But everyone should read Shark Infested Custard. It is a great book. And
yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah, it's a great book. I have, you know, I have a whole bookshelf dedicated to his stuff. And
shifting gears a little bit, many folks are struggling right now, obviously, due to the pandemic. It's hard to get their creative juices flowing. Do you have any tricks or means of getting your creativity flowing?
Turning off your phone and going for long walks is really good. Free writing is always helpful. If people want to get creativity tips, you know, my go-to person for all my creativity tips is I go to a woman named Kim Krizan on Instagram. It's KimKrizan. She's most well known as the co-creator of the Before Sunrise trilogy, and she's been posting little writing exercises to get your creativity going. And so, and then when I get tired of looking at her Instagram, I just turn to her since we're married, and then I ask her what I should be doing.
Good answer.
So with how long you've worked in the industry, and maybe you found it, but what did you want to be when you were little?
You know, I wanted to work in entertainment. I wanted to work in TV and film. I went to film school, and I also wanted to do comics. And, I worked in special effects and motion capture early on. I worked for the company that developed all this stuff for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and got to work with Digital Domain on stuff, got to work with David Fincher on an Adidas commercial. There was an Adidas commercial where it's like a robot playing basketball. And so I produced the motion capture for that. There was some like end of the world movie where it's like snowing like tomorrow.
Day after tomorrow.
Yeah. I produced the motion capture where they're walking through the snow. We hooked up like sandbags on the back of people's feet so that it would look like they were, you know, weight. And yeah, so I'm a pretty hard headed person. And so I wanted to do that stuff, and I did most everything I wanted to do. And it's funny. I don't go back to Texas a lot, but I still have family there. And I was back in Texas, and my dad and I went out to dinner with some of my cousins that I used to hang out with in the 80s. I hadn't seen for years. And they're like, Chip, what do you do? And my dad was like, he's doing the exact same thing he did as a teenager. He's selling comic books. And I'm like, well, yeah, I am.
Okay, Chip, tell us, what comics are you reading for pleasure right now? Because I know you're obviously reading comics for work as well.
What comics am I reading for pleasure? Oh, Lord. You know, most recently, I really, I have Bad Weekend here because I really love anything that Ed does is, you know, I'll read. Ed and Sean are like, you know, like the Lennon McCartney of crime comics. So, And Jacob Phillips, who we got to do a lobby card for us for the rewards for the Kickstarters. We haven't even talked about the lobby cards. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they're just a murderer's row of people that did lobby cards for my Kickstarter. I'm losing my talking points. Bad Weekend's just, you know, that's the latest, best comic
that I've read.
Yeah, I'm looking actually at your Kickstarter right now. You've got Eduardo Risso. You've got, obviously, you've got Francesco. You've got some amazing artists that have histories in Mirka and Dolfo. How do you pull all these people? Dan Panosian? Like, you've got folks that are like known for crime comic book storytelling. How did you pull all these together?
You just go, Pete, who are your friends?
BCC them all.
BCC them all. And then went out to some people that I didn't have relationships with, and it's worked out.
Okay, Chip, we have reached our last segment of the show.
Uh-oh.
And in our last segment, we dump gack all over your head. No, it's called Off Topic Top Shelf. We want to know what you're into right now that's not comics related. Can be anything.
Genealogy. I'm hugely big genealogy guy.
So tell us, what does that entail? What is that a day-to-day of genealogy hobbying? What does that look like?
It has sort of comic book origins. So like when I was a kid, I used to like fantasize about, you know, I worked in a comic book store as a teenager, and I'd fantasize about having my own. And I love books, you know, so I wanted to have like a book comic book store, and I just would fantasize about that. And then about 10 years ago, so my last name, you know, I'm kind of blessed with a weird last name, Mosier. And so about 10 years ago, I found out that there was a publisher, Thomas Bird Mosier, who's around during the arts and crafts era, 1890s through 1920, and did these limited run, really nice books, and like Auden, not Auden, who was the poet that did The Road Not Less Traveled?
Frost?
Yeah, Frost. Like, Frost loved Thomas Bird Mosier's book so much, he like went to him and was like, I want you to publish my first poetry collection. And Thomas Bird Mosier was like, yeah, I don't like your stuff. but one of the things that Thomas Bird Mosier was known for was stealing copyrights. Basically, is like taking works from the UK and publishing them without permission. But the authors in the UK would get these books, and they were so beautiful and well done that they you know would turn a blind eye, you know. So authors like kind of wanted him to steal their work, and he was doing like 400 copies or 500 copies. And anyway, you can go on eBay and Google Thomas Bird Mosier, and you'll see these books, and they're beautiful. So I was like, oh, I got to figure out if I'm related to this guy, and I knew my great grandfather Mosier's name was Alfred Roy. And so I'm looking for Thomas Bird Mosier in the 1890s, and I see this bookstore owner, George Alfred Mosier. And I knew that my grandfather had a sister, Georgia. And I was like, well, this is too weird. And then I did a little research, and I'm like, holy crap, my great-great-grandfather, George Alfred Mosier, owned a bookstore for 20 plus years in Syracuse, New York. And so I've gone down a rabbit hole on that, and I found a picture of the bookstore from 1894.
This is more detective work.
Yeah, I found all his old ads.
It sounds like there's some filling in the blank going on, like storytelling inside the truth of it all too, right? Do you write all this down? Do you have like notebooks filled, or how does it?
Oh my God. Yeah. I have, yes. I have a researcher that I pay money.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
You know, wow.
This is like my, you know, people spend money on comics.
Yeah. Yeah.
I spend my money on genealogy. So I have a researcher that I pay who deep dives on stuff I don't have time to. And she collates reports. And then I have, you know, at some point, maybe I'll publish a book or something on it. But, you know, I recently found out that the first boss that ran Truth Magazine tried to get, they were called suckerless. So in the 20s, there's like, you know, the people doing these get rich quick schemes would sell
the sucker lists to each other, and that was their mailing lists of the suckers that would participate. And so my great grandfather's boss, S.E. Cox, was hitting up Ponzi to get his sucker list, and Ponzi wanted too much money, and it's documented in like all of Ponzi's like
this guy's name is Ponzi.
Yeah, like the Ponzi.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy.
This is the guy who created the Ponzi scheme. And so, like, my great grandfather is like one degree of separation from the Ponzi.
Well, Chip, thanks for sharing. And you still have when this recording goes up, you'll have 24 more days to back Blacking Out. We suggest you check it out. And Chip, thank you so much for taking your time to talk with us. This has been great.
Yeah, you know, if you want to do a whole genealogy podcast, you know, I can talk your ear off for.
I think you need to start a genealogy podcast. That's what you need to do. It could be like Serial. You'll have you whisper into your microphone. You have great music to like get the mood right. You hear like people like, you know, mining when you get to that part of the story where one of your ancestors was in a coal mine and saved everyone, dragged every single person out, including the little bird.
Well, do you have my Kickstarter page up?
I do.
Read The Last Reward.
LA Noir Crime Tour with Chip. Oh, there you go. It all comes full circle. The $200 tier plus you will be responsible for getting to LA, but Chip will provide transportation. It'll be the time of your life. Black Dahlia's last known sighting. Chip knows. Biggie's murder. Chip knows. I love how this is written. Nicole Brown Simpson, Chip knows. Where Elroy's mother's body was found, Chip's been there with Elroy himself.
True story.
Hillside Strangler, yeah, you know the answer now. Spend a couple hours with Chip and hear how Cato Kalin ended up being buying him a round of drinks for his 30th birthday.
True story. You didn't read the last bit.
Oh, sorry.
Of where the lunch happens.
If you're super nice, he might take you to lunch at the old place in Malibu where his great uncle's murderer turned himself in when it was post office circa 1943.
My great uncle was murdered in 1943 out here in Malibu, and his father, my great great grandmother, was killed by a butcher knife to the neck in 1890 in Montana.
Oh my God.
But hey, you know.
I'm beginning to understand why you have over 100 plots yet to be written.
Yeah. I'll never get, you know, if I get to another one of them, it'll be a damn miracle.
Well, Chip, thank you so much for coming on.
There you go. Thank you. Super appreciate it.